guys.
I know. I'm thinking,
guys.
What's the
guys.
Whole thing with airplanes?
Shh. Okay. Okay. So now, before we look at the really traumatizing material, let me suggest to you what is actually less traumatizing. Okay. So yesterday, I okay. So the guys in my shear will know that there are certain people who every so often listen to our shear. And if I get a message post-shear from one of my friends named Rabbi Adam Ariel, I panic because, and he might listen to this, and then he might tell me, don't say it, I say it every time, there are very few people in this world who, when I know they've listened to my shear and then send me a follow-up, where I completely panic. Because he always, inevitably, has some thought on the sugya that I did not think of, some source that I should have seen that I missed somewhere every single time. So yesterday, I got a WhatsApp from Adam. And Adam said to me that he thinks he has no proof for this. Now, whenever you say you have no proof for something, and you're about to say something radical, right? So I'm skeptical, as is Ray Ginsberg. He was skeptical when I began telling it to him. By the end of me finishing my sentence, he's like, he had the same response I did, which is, that's brilliant, it might actually be true. I don't know whether it's true, right? But it really might be. So here's what Adam...
This is what Adam suggested.
We have no proof for this. But, as I mentioned a few days ago, how many psukim do Chazal claim that we have in the Torah? 5,888. How many does the back of our Chumash have?
5,845.
Good. How many psukim, if you actually count our Chumash, are there? 5,846. Right, we're not doing very well with this. Right? We're not doing very well with this. There are actually explanations to this, but for another time. The point is that we know, b'vada'ut, me'achuz, right, 100%, we know that the breakup of psukim, which obviously when you open a chumash, there are no breakup of psukim. Right? No. Prakim is Christian. Right? But psukim, the breakup of psukim, you open up a chumash, there is no evidence. Right? The breakup of psukim depends on the misorah of the trup, right? Of the tamim. Right? And you can easily turn one pasuk into two through an asnachta. Right? Yes, we all remember our bar mitzvah. Right? Right? In the middle. Right? The like semicolon equivalent in the pasuk, right? That half break in the middle, right? Which is like a clause, but not at the end of a pasuk, right? Etnachta. Yeah? Right? Meaning, when you are laning, right? No, etnachta, right? When you are laning, right, there are parts of the pasuk which can easily be broken up into two psukim if you wanted, right? Because they're basically clauses, and there are many psukim that you could, without doing any harm to the meaning of the psukim, take two or three psukim and turn it into a single pasuk. Right? So Adam WhatsApp me and he said, well, he has no proof for this, and the Ibn Ezra did not believe this, because the Ibn Ezra had our psukim. Right? But he said he thinks that there's good reason to believe that Chazal thought exactly what the Ibn Ezra thought. Because what unit do we have in the Sefer Torah? What is the smallest, right, full unit in a Torah? What is it called?
Pasuk.
Not a pasuk, but a parsha, right? Meaning in the Torah, right? You look at it, right? The unit parshiot to chot and stumot, you know, like from space to space, right? There are psukim within it, but like the smallest conceptual unit is really, right? Or like full conceptual unit is a parasha.
I thought you meant like parsha.
No, not like a sedra, not like what we call a parsha, which is like what we read in a week, but a parsha, like from Ptucha to Ptucha, or Ptucha to Stumar, Stumat to Stumar, Stumat to Ptucha. Yes? No? So people don't know what this is. Yeah. You will know this by the end of the year because we are doing Menachot and we are doing Sifrei Torah. You'd better get your hand on this. But that's very simple, right? A Parsha, right, or a Parshia, right, whatever you want to distinguish it, is simply space to space in a Chumash. You can imagine this? Spaces? See? Spaces? Right? Right? You open a Sefer Torah, you've all gotten Aliyah, looked at a Tikkun. That is the smallest conceptual unit. And he said it would be very strange, right? He said, Chazal talk about, right? It would be very strange. Normally, what opens or closes a parasha? Why do you have a different parasha?
A different topic,
right? A different topic, or sometimes in a conversation, right? Like between speeches, right? When different speakers, so then you'll open and close a parsha. Said, wouldn't you think, logically, that if according to Chazal, the last unit, the last eight psukim of the Torah were either written by Yehoshua, meaning a different author because Moshe dies, or by Moshe in a radically different way, that would deserve a parsha break, right? Right? Don't you think it would deserve a parsha break? And therefore, he said again, he's like, I am so convinced that this is true that one day we will find proof that this is true, but I don't know where. Okay. And again, I don't know if this is true, but he said he thinks that Chazal actually had what we have as the last 12 psukim were only 8, and they actually think what the Ibn Ezra thought, and that entire unit, right? And that when Chazal say Vayamat Sham Moshe, they don't mean starting at the words Vayamat Moshe; they mean the unit in which the Vayamat Moshe is included. Again, I have no raya for this whatsoever, but. You know, both Regensburg and I are a bit cynical and very, very skeptical of things. And both of us, by the end of hearing this, were like, we don't know if it's true, but I can't prove it to you with any, right, conviction that this is not true. And I just want to read you the last psukim of the Torah and tell me that this is not at least a possibility. Okay? Again, a possibility, I don't know how many times I can qualify that. But, okay, I'm going to read the psukim and tell you where the psukim breaks are, and tell me if there is anywhere where you might think that it would not do any harm to the meaning of the psukim to make that a comma instead of a sof pasuk. Okay, so we just start this. Vayal Moshe Marvot Moav Harnavo Rosh Apiskar Shalpnei Recho Vayreva Adonai Kol Eretz Erkol Aretz Vedha Gilad Adan. That's pasuk aleph, right? Hashem showed him the whole land Adan. Then pasuk bet is V'et kol Naftali, right? And he showed him Naftali, right? V'et Eretz Ephraim Menashe v'et kol Eretz Yehuda ad Yam Acharon, right? That's all of pasuk bet. Pasuk gimel V'et Hanegev, right? Now, how much would it change the meaning of the pasuk if we just read this as one long pasuk, which is Hashem showed Moshe Dan Naftali the Negev? How much would that change it? Nothing, right? Like, who cares? You, right? So it would just change the trop. So it wouldn't be a sof pasuk. It would be whatever, right? Correct. But you could, without doing pretty much any harm, right? Any damage to the meaning of the psukim, you could put all the places that Hashem showed Moshe in one long pasuk. Right?
What's the reason
you were separating? So Chazal, right? Or the Masorah that we have, rather, not Chazal, right? Right, this is always the problem, is that Chazal, the Masorah that we have of our Pesukim is, right, like our, like this, it comes from a period a little bit later than Chazal, the Bali Masorah, Ben Asher and Ben Naftali, right? So we don't actually know how they would have broken up their Pesukim, right? So what Adam suggests is that it is not impossible to believe that Chazal actually had 8 Pesukim in where we have 12, and that Chazal meant, even though the Ibn Ezra didn't know this, what the Ibn Ezra meant, which would make the Ibn Ezra's claim, at least about the 12, much less radical. I had to throw that out. Again, I have zero proof for this, right? None of us have any proof for this.
Isn't that what the sheets of the book said, that we split it out from the rest of it?
Oh, correct, but where does the breakup, right? What he's arguing is that maybe Chazal meant, not starting at Pasuk Hey, right, but the whole unit, which includes Vayamat Shem Moshe, which they had as 8 psukim. And that would solve the problem, because then you'd say that the whole unit about Moshe's death is just written by Yehoshua / Moshe Bedema, starting from the beginning to the end. Again, I cannot prove. Again, I have no proof for this, but I figured I at least have to throw it out, because it is not a theory which lacks merit, right? There is an internal logic to it. That is the radical suggestion for the day, which I have no proof for. Sorry, the Ibn Ezra said that when Chazal said the last eight psukim were, I know you weren't here, you were in Serbia or something, that the last eight psukim, Chazal said the last eight psukim when Moshe dies are either written by Yehoshua or Moshe Bedema, whatever that means. The Ibn Ezra expands that to the last 12 from when Moshe leaves never to return. Okay, fine. That's closed parentheses. If you want to ignore everything I just said, that's fine. If you think it's interesting, good. If you ever find proof, please let me know, because I have none. I looked a lot last night, but I don't even know where I would find proof. Right? Like, you can't find it from an old Sefer Torah. It wouldn't help you, because there are no psukim breaks. Right? What you would need is, like, some old Targum or something from, like, 2,000 years ago that does. So I, like, looked in the Septuagint, and, like, I tried looking the Peshitta, and I don't know. I don't know how you would even find proof for this. Fine. Okay. Now, to catch Nachum up, welcome back. Yay!
I'm no longer the only one from first year.
That's true. And Shimon's back too. I don't know if he'll be in our she hasn't decided yet. But theoretically. Okay. So, we... again. So, Chazal claimed the last eight psukim are either written by Yehoshua, because Moshe is dead, or by Moshe Bedema, whatever that means, but some way is distinct from the rest of the Torah. The Ibn Ezra expands this, and we talked about the problems in this, but the Ibn Ezra takes the logic of Chazal and is... expands it, and he says, look, I don't understand. If the problem is that Moshe can't write past tense about his death, he also can't write past tense about disappearing, never to return, and therefore claims that you have to expand the purview of Yoshua's writing to the last 12 psukim from when Moshe goes up to Har Nevo. Now, we noted that this entire unit, this entire sugya, especially at this point, is very theologically loaded. So loaded, in fact, that in the Gemara, they're yelling at each other about whether it's possible Moshe didn't write the whole Torah. The Rishonim are so bothered by the possibility that Moshe didn't write the whole Torah that they reject the position of Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nehemiah in the Gemara, right? A lot of the Rishonim are just not willing to entertain a position that is, in fact, entertained by Chazal explicitly. Much less are they willing to entertain the Ibn Ezra, who says, first of all, it's not 8, it's not 12, and it's not 12, it's 16, right? And we went through the places in the rest of the Torah where Ibn Ezra pulls phrases or psukim and claims that they were written by Yoshua or some later prophet. But I promised you that just for completeness, I would have to traumatize you one more time, and I promised you that after this we're going to less traumatic thing, because after this we're going to the next line in the Gemara about the mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah, where I hope you do not experience nearly as much trauma as I do when I read this sugya, because every time I read this sugya, I get a little bit of panicky, my hands sweat. When I read Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, I check myself for the 50th time that I'm reading what I think I'm reading. Right? No matter how many times I read Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, I don't believe it. What? Yeah, exactly. No matter how many times I read it, it doesn't matter, right? The first time I saw it, I was in YU, right? And it didn't matter how many times I've seen it since then. It's been many, many, many times. And every time I'm like, wow, the Hasidei Ashkenaz were wild, right? Really, they were crazy. So who are the Hasidei Ashkenaz? Let's do a little bit of history here. I feel very like, so this past week for, I don't know if anyone has heard, but there was a Rebbe in Gush for many, many years who passed away, Rav Binyamin Tabori, he was a Talmud of the Rav. He spent many years in other communities. He spent a few years in Toronto. He was one of the first Rosh Yeshiva of Or Chaim back in the day. He was in London for a year. He was in LA for a while. He'd been fighting ALS for quite a number of years. But one of the things, you know, I sort of, as I do things that I know he would do in Shir, like one, which is focusing on the Psukim and not just jumping to the Gemara, and two, is telling stories about the people we're talking about. I feel very much like I'm channeling him during his week of Shir. I wasn't so close to him, honestly. He was much closer to my wife, because he also taught in Moshe Va for many, many, many years. I.O. for, right, and not the one in Canada, not in this bar, or the other ones. Yes, Nachum, the American who went to Ennismar. Well, yes, and I.O., Indian Orchard. Yes, not the one in Wisconsin either, and not the one in California. Not any of those. What? Not Wild Rose and not Malibu or whatever it is now.
Whatever it is.
It's not Malibu anymore, whatever it is. But anyway, so I feel like I'm channeling a bit at the moment. Who are the Hasidei Ashkenaz? Who are the Hasidei Ashkenaz? Or in English, if you want to be overly formal, the German Pietists. What? No. You are off by only about 700 years. Maybe not 700, but 500-600 years. Right? The German Pietists are of the Tosavist era. Right? They are French German. Right? But they are, they are Pietists. They are Hasidim. They are interesting. They are mystically inclined. No, not Kabbalah, the different mystical tradition than Kabbalah, a mystical tradition that comes down from the Kalonymus family in the Rhineland, right? So different mystical traditions than Kabbalah, right? Kabbalah, what we know as Kabbalah, is a Kabbalistic tradition specifically that came down through the Rivet, right? Through Provence into Spain.
They were their whole separate thing.
This is a different tradition, right? How they're related depends on how you understand how all these traditions work together, but let's just suffice it to say that the traditions that we know of or refer to colloquially as Kabbalah are mystical traditions that come out of the base medrash of the Rivet, right? And are in Spain, and basically there are two major traditions we're talking about there, the Catalonian tradition and the Castilian tradition, right? Those traditions, and then maybe Luriana Kabbalah talking a bit later, but the German Pietist tradition is a different mystical tradition. There are big differences, right? Kabbalah talks about the 10 emanations of God, right? The Sfirot. The German Pietists talk about 3, right? There are major differences between these mystical traditions. They are not the same, right? This is a shir maybe for another time. But they are mystics. They are also, but primarily they are Pietists, right? Hasidim. What does that mean? So that means that they heavily critique the Balei HaTosfot because they do not love the intellectualism of the Balei HaTosfot, which they think has bred hubris. Arrogance in less. Hubris. The lumdus of Rabbeinu Tam and things like that. They want people to focus on halacha. They want people to focus on davening and kavana. In some of their more radical positions, they are also into not just asceticism, no, they're mystics, not Kabbalah, right? Kabbalah is a specific mystical tradition. Asceticism and a little bit more than asceticism sometimes. Self-flagellation, rolling around in the snow. In certain cases, you have stories of them using shemot to save themselves, and Rabbi Yehuda Chassid getting really angry at them and making them go back on the same dangerous road they were on and let themselves get killed, right? Like, they are an interesting bunch, right? They talk about when you do tshuva, it's Elul. Yes, you should, you know, you should beat yourself and things like that. Fast, beat yourself. What?
Beat yourself.
Yes, like self-flagellation. Yes, like part of Yisurin.
Flagellation,
like whipping yourself.
Give me the other one, right?
No, I heard flatulation.
No, flatulation. That's just because you don't know the word. Anyways, right?
Like sounds beating.
How do you like? How does that harm yourself?
And also, if you know me,
take a whip, make yourself bleed. How does that make? How does that not hurt yourself? Right?
If you know me, that's the first thing I think of anytime anyone says anything.
That's why. That's why it makes sense.
Oh, for God's sake. Okay. Anyways, these are the German Pietists, people. Guys, these are the Hasidei Ashkenaz. Okay? The Hasidei Ashkenaz are an interesting group, various levels of extremism, depending on which one you're talking about. Very interesting group of people. Now, to be fair, they do actually have a lot of influence. Well, it's not clear how much they have, but they don't have no influence, because many of the Balei HaTosfot also studied by the German Pietists, and therefore many of their halachot actually, their positions actually make it into halacha, some of which is rejected as just being their thing, but some of it makes it in. And by the way, you say tefillot that are written by them and have all types of mystical connotations that you have no idea that you're saying, right? Things like Anam Zmirot, right, which comes from the Hasidei Ashkenaz, and, you know, shocker, does not actually refer directly to God, right? It is a song which is not about God directly. It's about his kavod, which is an emanation. Well, sort of. Whatever. Complicated. But, whatever. Interesting things going on in Hasidei Ashkenaz. So, Rabbi Yehuda Chassid is the most well-known of the Hasidei Ashkenaz. Has many significant students, right? People like Rabbi Elazar of Worms, also known as the Rokeach, Worms, Vermeisha, whatever, Germany. By the end, you'll have some knowledge of history and geography, something, I hope, right? You'll pick it up slowly. So, Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, also, we discovered in the last 100 years or so, some of his commentary on the Torah. And as people began to read Rabbi Yehuda Chassid's papers on the Torah, we realized, wow, not only Are you anti the intellectualism of the Balandeotosos and a mystic and into self-flagellation sometimes and all types of interesting different things that you do? You also have really radical views about the Torah. And that's where that brings us to Yehuda HaChassid. But that's the background. So just remember that the person we're talking about, big Talmud Chacham, a lot of influence, but this is not the only thing we haven't accepted from him. You know, you also don't beat yourself senseless before Yom Kippur, so, you know, most of you don't. Most of you don't. There are, by the way, it is back in vogue, right, to do symbol, you know, now with like the rise of like Neo-Hasidim and things like that, it is like in vogue to do symbolic whippings. What? Whatever. Like, I don't know when this happened, but I remember already there were people in yeshiva, a few, who like Erev Yom Kippur would ask you to do symbolic whipping, and they would give you a shoelace and ask you to whip them. Which I always said, no, that's really weird. That's really, really odd. It's really, 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 really strange. Not in this yeshiva. The yeshiva I went to. What? Which is also not a yeshiva, which is identified usually with that type of thing. But that's fine.
Should we start making it identify with that sort of thing?
What?
Should we start making it identify with that sort of thing?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. You're allowed to attend classes.
Yes, that's our new onesh. If you come late to Seder, we will symbolically whip you. Symbolically. Symbolically. Symbolic punishment. And the next time you will symbolically come on time. Right? You will text me, I am here. Yes.
Rabbinical lashes are still a thing.
Yes, exactly. What?
Can't you still implement rabbinical lashes?
No. Please don't do that. Please don't beat anybody with a whip. I beg you.
I'm not a rabbi, but...
Okay, I am not planning on whipping anybody. I hope that was clear. Maybe we didn't make that clear enough in orientation. But no, we don't whip. Thank you.
In our days, there's no malchus, anyway.
Thank you. Right? There was an attempt, admittedly, in the 16th century to bring back Malkos. That is true, right? That is true. That is an interesting historical story in and of itself. That was when they tried to reinstitute Smicha in Tzfat. The Maribe Rav, right, tried to reinstitute Smicha. May have actually somewhat succeeded, given Smicha to a few people. The reason they wanted to do it was because they wanted to create Bate Din to give Malkos to the Muranos, who felt guilty about having converted to Christianity, and they thought they were going to get Kares, and since the Gemara says that you can write a mitzvah, a nevera for which you get Kares, you will get Kapara if you have Malkos. They wanted to get Malkos because they felt like they were being cut off spiritually because they converted to Christianity, and therefore they wanted to have Malkos administered to them, and therefore to do that they needed Smicha, so they went through and instituted Smicha. It's a whole interesting, very, very, very long story. One of the weirdest, also one of the weirdest historical stories that has ever happened, right? It turned into a very, very strange machlokes between Mari Berav and representing the rabbis of Tzvat and the rabbis of Yerushalayim, who were Maral Bach, Rav Levi ben Chaviv, and Rav Yaakov Chazan. If you want to read about that, Jacob Katz has written very, very long articles on this. But to be fair, even to read the tshuva by the Maral Bach will take you forever. I put it once on Word from Bar Ilan. It was 101 single-spaced pages or something like that. So, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. Now back to Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. Okay, now that we've framed him. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. So, the Ibn Ezra... Yes, Darius. About? Azazel. Why?
Because it's like such a complicated history of like where the name comes from. And
oh, sure. Look.
Can I like read that?
Do it afterwards, because you'll be even more traumatized what you're reading here.
No, this is more traumatizing.
I know, that's what I'm saying. You'll be more traumatized. Right, like what the Ramban thinks Azazel means is really traumatizing.
No, but this is worse.
Right, you know, like the Ramban actually says, like, that when we say you send a seir la Azazel on Yom Kippur, it's, as Rav Lichtenstein once summarized it, because God has a dog and he wants you to throw it a bone, right, to an idol, or the devil,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, this is...
Yes, good. Yes, it is disturbing. Yes, it is.
I don't want to get into...
No, you don't. Good. Okay, guys.
But it goes far.
Yes, I know. Yes, I know, Darius.
And it turns into like...
Yes, I know. I know. Okay, guys. Guys. So with all this as background. So, as we saw, Chevra, the Ibn Ezra, as we saw, as radical as he was, A, tried to be very secretive about it. B was minimalist in it, right? Because he was at least uncomfortable, right? Again, whether you accept or reject Ibn Ezra, he was at least uncomfortable with what he was doing. But Ezra and Pesach very nicely points out the passages we're about to read from the Chassidei Ashkenaz. They apparently were not uncomfortable at all with what they were about to do. And where we began with the Ibn Ezra, right? They were just like, they just played fast and loose with, right, with authorship issues. Apparently this just didn't bother them. Why? I don't know. Right? I have no idea. Maybe it's the same reason that, like, modern Hasidim, not like Hasidim, but Neo-Hasidim, like people who are inspired by Hasidish thought but are, like, you know, modern Orthodox or, like, yeshivish but just sort of read Hasidus on the side, right? Suddenly you find articles by them writing, well, it doesn't really matter who wrote the Torah because, like, you know, it's just about God talking to you and, like, who really cares about history? History is like a detail, right? Like, it's about the spiritual message of it. I don't know, right? I don't know. I don't buy those articles and I don't buy this, but it isn't, I don't know. But they really said some really shocking things, and again, I'm not telling this to you because I'm endorsing it. I am not. I'm really not endorsing it on any level. Not theological, historical, linguistic, literary. There is no level at which I think anything I'm about to read is compelling. I'm bringing it to you for completeness, right? Which is to understand that, right, there are, right, that the discussion begun by Chazal of is it true that everything in the Torah is written by Moshe, or can one be a believing Jew in Torah's Moshe and still not believe in the pure authorship that you would get if you just read the Animamins of the Rambam, right, if we put it simply, is that possible? What I want to convince you of is that, yes, it is possible for someone to, with integrity, be part of the Jewish tradition, believe that they are following Torah's Moshe, and not have a Rambam-esque view of what that means. Right? That is all I'm trying to prove, because to be fair, right, you read the Animamin of the Rambam, even the position Chazal of the last eight psukim, right, is suspect. Right? Okay, so what did Rabbi Yehuda Chazan say? So he has a few. So example number one was Breishit Lamed Vav Lamed Tet. So what does Breishit Lamed Vav Lamed Tet say? Who has it open? Breishit Lamed Vav Lamed Tet.
Oh yeah, got it.
What? Yeah, so why does that pasuk even... Yeah, that's right. So why is this at all problematic, right? So this is part of it, right? He has this on Dvarim. What his real problem is, right, this is background, is from Etzion Gaver, right? Is that in Bamidbar we find that the Jews reached Etzion Gaver, which is described as belonging to, right, Edom, but only later, right? That Etzion, right, so, sorry, the background to it is, in Devarim, we know that we try to go through Edom. They don't let us, right? One of the cities there is Etzion Gaver. The problem is that Edom being in Etzion Gaver happens in a much later time. So what is Rabbi Yehuda HaChatzid's solution to this? That this pasuk was written in the time of Shlomo, right? Which is, again, very radical, because first of all, we move this by how many years after the Torah?
Many,
thank you. Good, many. That's the right answer. What?
600 to 1,000?
No, not that much. Right?
400.
How many years?
Well, Yoshua lives, right, 20 some odd years, right, after Moshe, right?
Right.
Then the period of the Shoftim is, you're talking maybe 600 years. Yeah, maybe 600 years. Yeah, not 1,000. 600. Right, it's only not 600. Yeah, okay.
Yesterday's estimates, yeah.
Yeah. Now that is weird, because but at least you understand where he's coming from. You understand the problem, right? Which is Etzion Gaver being in Edom happens later, okay? So that, you can always say, well, no, Etzion Gaver is already there. I mean, there's two Etzion Gavers, who knows, right? But at least there's a problem. What seems to be weird is that at least Ibn Ezra only posited that things were not written by Moshe when he had a problem to deal with, just like Chazal, right? Yehuda HaChassid seems to have been so okay with this that he brings it up even when there is no obvious problem. So, his next example was by the Brachot of Ephraim and Menashe. Right? Which he says, right, now this is admittedly in the Torah, but it's weird, right? He says that pasuk is not about Yaakov, it's about
Moshe.
Right? And it means that Moshe put Ephraim as the leader of one camp and as, right, Menashe of the other, which is just, as Rav Bazak notes correctly, just weird. Right? Just weird. Like, what problem did you have in that pasuk that drove you to say that? It's a worse read. Right? Ibn Ezra only brought these up when there was a problem in the pasuk that he was trying to solve. Yehuda HaChassid apparently created problems by having less compelling reads that also carried with them theological issues. I don't know why he did this. Now, by far the craziest thing that he ever said in his entire Perush is the last one. And that is the Anu Be'er Enula. Please explain to me what Yehuda HaChassid did with Anu Be'er Enula. What did he do? This is from Bamidbar Perakav Aleph. Yes, what happened? Good, they sing a song. The Torah tells us that they sing a song because of some miracle, which we don't know exactly what it is, and we don't know what song they sang. Right? What? So what did Rav Yehuda HaChassid say? Yes, so what is it? It is Hallel HaGadol. What is Hallel HaGadol? Oh, please. Guf Lamed Vav. Yes, what is it? You all know it. Yes, the Kila Olam Chasdo Perek. You know, you say it in Sukkotism Rav Shabbos, right? Hodu Lashem Kito Kila Olam Chasdo. That whole thing, it's, you know, not short, right? He says, that is from Chumash, and then they cut it out, and David put it in Tehillim because, hey, that's a nice song. Tehillim's a book of songs. Let's just remove that from Chumash conveniently, leave you wondering what that song was that they sang by the Be'er, and let's just put it in Tehillim. I haven't the foggiest idea what drove anybody to say what I just said. I have no idea. Okay?
They're using a forgery to claim David did a forgery as well.
Not a forgery. Chazal already say that Tehillim is not all written by David. It's compiled by David and 10 authors. Right? Among whom is Moshe. Right? Right? Tfilah leMoshe Isha Elohim. Right? Meaning it's not a forgery. It's just, he's like, I think we should reorganize, right? We should reorganize. Instead of it being in volume 1, it should be in volume 3 of Torah, right? Again, I have, and this is, I gave you Rabazak's article rather than just giving you the pieces in, first of all, to be nice, but also because I agree with Rabazak that Chazal in their 8 Psukim, at least what drove them to make the claim at the 8 Psukim? Yes, or basically, necessity, right? Textual problems. The Ibn Ezra, he may be radical, right? But at least, like Chazal, he only does it when he feels compelled. And yesterday what we did was figure out, is he actually right? Is this actually compelling? Or are there other interpretations? But at least the Ibn Ezra only brought this up when he thought there was a need. Yehuda HaChassid, for reasons that are totally unclear to anybody, right? Really unclear. Again, I don't know what drives any human being to say what I just said, right? Like, it is so bizarre, right, that Anu Be'er Enula means that there was once a song, which is now an entire perek in Tehillim, that used to be part of Chumash, which, by the way, thematically, stylistically, does not fit Chumash, ki hu zeh, right? There is never, anywhere, right? Even the songs we have in Chumash look nothing like that. Of all the prakim he could have picked, I don't know what, I really, like, as Yashir is not a song with a refrain, right? That's a song with a refrain. Ki lolam chasdo, ki lolam chasdo. Right? The songs that we have in Chumash, Az Yashir Ha'azinu, are like song songs, right? Not like refrain songs, like, you know, songs that are hard to memorize the lyrics, not songs, right, that are easy to memorize the lyrics, you know, like good Jewish songs, right? Good Jewish songs, right? You know, you take 3 psukim, you just sing them over and over and over again, and they are meaningless and have nothing, at least Tehillim is meaningful, right? Jewish songs, like, you pick random psukim and... Yes. As my guys know, I'm not the biggest fan of much of Jewish music because, you know, a lot of it shows absolutely no understanding of the words that they are singing. Yeah, you know, they sing things with Drosser, they sing things that make no sense, they sing things that are bad for Jazara, whatever, right? Because they didn't butt. I don't.
What songs do you listen to then, Rabbi?
Kanye.
Well, you know the song Chazak Chazak Vinit Chazek Ishet Re'eu Yazaru Lachiv Yomar Chazak?
What?
You know, it's like an old song.
I never heard that last part.
Ish Israel, you no. Yes, it's a very, very old song. Anyways, the pasuk in context is about people encouraging other people to worship Avodah Zarah. Why that became a nice Jewish song? Totally and completely beyond me.
I thought you meant like Adam Sviras, which is the stuff.
No, I meant like straight up idolatry in the Torah. Not like, I'm not using that metaphorically. I'm using it as, this actually talks about idolatry.
Like Adam Sviras,
yes, but as I said, it's not really talking about God, it's talking about his emanation, so it's okay. I'm talking about the kavod. Not a number. Okay. Now, the interesting thing that happened with this Yehuda Chassid, now, it appears in other sources as well, in this book of Rav Menachem Tzioni ben Meir, right, who... All I know about him is what I put here, right? He lived in Germany circa 1340 to 1410, wrote a Kabbalistic commentary on the Torah called Sefer Tzioni, as well as several liturgical poems. And if you want to know more about this interesting figure, look at all the people that Rav Bazak put in his footnote, because I've not bothered to read them. He also has these interpretations. Now, these were brought to... Right now, he notes that other Hasidei Ashkenaz had this as well. Rav Shlomo, who was another of the Hasidim, did this about Azazel, right? Because what did he write? Right, what did he say, Darius, since this is the one that you were building on? He said, Azazel is not Hebrew, it's Aramaic, and therefore don't worry about it, it was written by someone not Moshe. That's a bit strange. By the way, there are two words in the Torah which are Aramaic, which are clearly in context meant to be Aramaic, which are
Yigar Sahaduta.
Thank you, Yigar Sahaduta. Right? What is Yigar Sahaduta? When Yaakov and Lavan make a pact, they make a to seal their pact. They make a matseva, which Yaakov calls Gal Aid, which means. Essentially, a mound of rocks that acts as testimony, right? Right? God, right? It's like, in this case, it's a mound of rocks, right? And right? And aid is its testimony, an aid. And what does Yigar Sahaduta mean? Gal aid in Aramaic, right? But Lavan calls it Gal aid because it's Lavan until he spoke Aramaic, so it's quoting Lavan, right? The Torah quotes Lavan, and Lavan did not speak Hebrew. Okay, he spoke Aramaic or some other proto-Semitic language along those lines. Some sort of Aramaic-like language. I don't know exactly what.
It would make sense because he's called Lavan Ha-Aramaic.
Correct, right. I mean, Aramaic, not Gemara Aramaic. I mean, it's Aramaic, it's not Gemara Aramaic, right? Gemara Aramaic is...
From the region of Aramaic.
Gemara Aramaic is yeshivish of the time of the Gemara, right? It's like a hodgepodge of, like, low Aramaic with a little bit of, you know, Hebrew mixed in and some random other words, right? Like Yiddish, right? It's like low German, right? Low German with a little bit of Hebrew, right? So he said Azazel is written later on. Now, as this developed historically, this is in the appendix, Ramosha was shown this piece. Now, as the Masorah goes in YU, he was shown the piece by Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's son. What did Ramosha say? What was Ramosha's response when he was faced with all these sources that we just saw?
Like, he could not possibly have read it.
Yes, it is a forgery. Forgery, I do not believe you. I do not believe you. And apparently, as the Masorah is passed around YU, Rabbi Dr. Soloveitchik says that he feels he could have convinced Ramosha that it was not a forgery if Ramosha had given him more time, but Ramosha had no interest in spending any more time looking at this book, and therefore pushed him out, and therefore he never got a chance to prove it to him. But that is how the story, as I heard the story around YU. Right, he just says, and why does he deny it? Why does he say this is a forgery? Because he says, one who suggests that Moshe wrote even a single letter on his own initiative denies the Torah and is included in the category of he who has despised God's word. All the more so one who says that there is some matter which was not written even by Moshe but rather by others, or that others came and removed some matter from the Torah. They deny the Torah and include in the category of he who has despised God's word. Meaning, this is crazy heresy. So, Sipur. Yes, Dov. Oh, yes. So then Rav Bazak, in wonderful historical irony. So this is the danger, right? Lesson in life. If the way you solve problems is by claiming that someone didn't write what they wrote, don't be surprised when someone does that to you, right? So in the historical irony of this, that Rav Moshe solved the problem by saying, I don't like what Rav Yehuda HaChassid said. I like Rav Yehuda HaChassid. Solution? Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid never wrote it. Do I have any evidence that it's a forgery? No. I just, my view of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid is positive. My view of these passages is that it's heresy. Someone I like cannot possibly be a heretic. It never happened. Right? But Rav Menashe Klein, who the Ungever Rebbe, the Ungever Rav, who lived in the two Halakha cities of Borough Park and Yerushalayim. What? Anyways, just turned around and was convinced that this, in fact, was written by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, and therefore used Ramosha's own tactic against him, and said, right, we do not have conclusive knowledge of who Rabbi Nachum HaTzioni was. It seemed that he copied to be found in some book with Rabbi Yehuda. Sorry. Ramosha also critiques Rabbi Nachum HaTzioni, right? And the Mishnah Halacha responds and says, but the truth is, I do not believe that this is said by Ramosha Feinstein, right?
Didn't Rabbi Soloveitchik go with
Chaim Soloveitchik, not... yeah, but I don't know. I doubt Chaim Soloveitchik ever talked to Menashe Klein, but whatever, you know. It's written. This is a tshuva by Ramosha, right? This is not like... It's not just like it's said. It's a tshuva by Ramosha, right? But he says, rather, it seems to me that some misguided student wrote it and included among his letters after his death, and the hands of strangers reigned over him and showed themselves a reputed scholar, for I do not believe that Moshe Feinstein had never seen Sefer HaTzioni, right? This is very classic. So, a little bit of background here. Certain poskim, you should just know, are huge Talmidei Chachamim, so huge and so independent that they really don't care what most people say. Rav Moshe was one of those people, right? He cared about the Gemara, he cared about the major Rishonim, he cared about Shulchan Aruch and the major Nosei Kelim, and he really didn't care about random Svarim, right? You read his Tshuvot, you will find very little random Svarim, right? It'll be like Gemara, basic Rishonim, basic Nosei Kelim on Shulchan Aruch, and that's how he's going to paskin, based on his own creativity, right? And the fact that some random Achron said something for Rav Moshe is almost irrelevant. Or... totally irrelevant, I don't know. Almost or completely. Then there are poskim who are very into precedent. They like quoting everybody that they can find their hands on. Right? So they get their hands on. So Rav Menashe Klein is like that. Right? He is very much a Hasidish posik in that way. He cares about minhag a lot. He cares about precedent a lot. And he quotes left, right, and center. So he says, I can't believe that Rav Moshe didn't know who this Rav Menashe HaTzioni was. The answer is, probably Rav Moshe did not know who this Sefer HaTzioni was, and he probably didn't care very much, because it's pretty random. But Rav Menashe Klein does care about it, and therefore he says, I can't believe that Rav Moshe wouldn't know this Sefer and would say that it's not important. It obviously was. It must be that some student forged this tshuva, and Rav Moshe never said it. This is the historical irony of this, right? You can't... And therefore, he writes that, no, this manuscript should not be hidden away, and thank God I've reviewed it, what they wrote, and I have seen that they should be interpreted in accordance with his approach, in accordance with the halakha, but this is not their place. Right? So with that, right, we come to the close of this, which is to just note, right, that, right, the Gemara introduces already the possibility, based on necessity, that the last Pesukim might not have been written by Moshe. That already is controversial, even in the time of Chazal. Right, because we really do believe that Torah is written by Moshe. And to say any psukim, even of necessity, are not written by Moshe, created controversy already in the time of Chazal. The Ibn Ezra follows that approach of the more expansive possibility of Rabbi Shimon, but only slightly, right? Expanding it by a few psukim here and there. But again, but of necessity, and even that elicited a tremendous amount of critique. As we saw, Rabbeinu Bachya, the Orachaim, etc. And therefore, as I said, it is unfair to use him as the, as Spinoza did, as the beginning of like biblical criticism, right, where you play fast and loose with the Torah, right? That's not what Ibn Ezra is doing. Whether you agree with him or not, that's not what he's doing. Rida Chassid already, I don't know what to tell you, right? He apparently had a very different view of the authorship of Torah than I do, where he really had no problem with psukim that are not of necessity, saying they weren't written when they should have been written, and taking psukim out of Torah and putting them elsewhere in Tanakh. Again, he's not modern Bible critic, right? He clearly still believed in the importance of Torah and thought it was from God, and that's why I assume he felt comfortable doing this, because it's all from God, so who cares, right? But it's very, very radical. I'm not endorsing it, right? And this will, you'll probably hear this a lot over the year, right? I'm not endorsing this position, but I also want to be intellectually honest enough to tell you that this position exists, and for you to understand where it emerged and where it didn't emerge, right? And we can sort of paint the picture of what was okay in the Gemara, what was controversial then, what the Ibn Ezra expanded, what Rida Chassid did, right? Where this comes from, where they're similar, and where they're obviously not. That brings us to the end of this sugya, which, as I said, was very much, I said at the beginning, was going to be a synthesis of a lot of different disciplines, right? And if you just sort of think about what we did in the last 5 days, right? Yes, it's been 5 days. Congratulations, you finished your first week of Shir, right? And you all survived. You all survived. Yay! Round of applause. Right, all survived, right? We've seen, right, the Gemara's attempt to deal with authorship issues, halachic issues, the relationship between them, how halacha doesn't, right? The Gemara has no problem dealing with those different disciplines, right, in synthesis, right? We dealt with, we had a day of classic halachic discussion, right? Yachid Koreosan, what justifies that argument conceptually. We had a day of just linguistic interpretation of the Gemara. What is it saying? How does it justify the problems? Right? We had a day where we tried to understand the connection between Tanakh and the Gemara to understand what drove them, right? And then we spent 2 days building on it and showing how often sort of things that start in the Gemara develop in their own life in different ways, in different disciplines. Throughout time, we've done a lot of different things. The sugya we'll do next week is a lot more classic, right? That's the next thing. So since we have a few more minutes, let me just set you up. The next lines in the Gemara, right? Literally picking up where we, right? After Ho Vishni Ishni introduces the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah. Okay? As you will see, the main sugya is discussed in two places, here in Menachot and in Sanhedrin, in the second parak, because in the second parak of Sanhedrin we are discussing the laws of the king. And as you all know, because by this point obviously you've started Shtai Mikra, the king has a unique mitzvah, which is write his own Torah, another Torah in addition to the Torah that everybody else has to write, which goes in and out with him. And therefore, in Menachot, where we're talking about Sefer Torah, we talk about the mitzvah to write the Sefer Torah. In Sanhedrin, when we're talking about the mitzvah of the king writing a Sefer Torah, we talk about the general mitzvah to write the Sefer Torah. Our goal for next week on Monday, Sunday you guys are at the Old City, Monday is going to be to figure out, is going to be a Psukim day. How do Chazal derive from the Pasuk that they quote the mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah? Hint, it's not easy, right? Or heads up, really. It's not easy. And you can blame Nachum, because Nachum likes when I do Shirim, where we just try to understand how we get from the Psukim to Halacha. So if you are breaking your teeth over all the positions who are trying to get it from the Gemara, blame Nachum. It's all his fault and mine, but you know. You can also, we'll share it. That will be the first day of Shir. Hopefully that only take 1 day. And then we will move to the Machloket Rishonim of how to understand the mitzvah, primarily Machloket Rashi and Rambam. And then the question of Bizman Hazeh, do you still have to write a Sefer Torah, or can you be OT with Svarim, which is an analysis of the Rush?
Did the Rush write a Sefer?
Yes, he did, and you will be able to find the relevant Rush in the back of your Gemara, because the Rush writes a halachic commentary, which is found on the back, in the back of your Gemara, in back of all Gemaras, and you will be looking at the Rush in the first halacha. The first halacha on the Rush, on Menachot and Halachot Ketanot, and based on the conceptual issues that we raised there, right? What's the nature of the mitzvah, the purpose of the mitzvah, and things like that, we will have to deal with certain questions like, is there a mitzvah nowadays? Are women chayev to write a Sefer Torah, given the fact that they are not obligated in the same way in learning Torah as men? And some other halakhic questions. Do you have to write it yourself? Can you pay someone else to write it for you? If you write it, do you have to keep it, or can you give it to the shul? Right? Things like that. And that will be at least half of next week. I don't know how long it'll take. Yeah.
this might be something you will answer next week, but do you have to write a preservatory or can write words? Like, let's say you can write one word.
Yep, that's going to be part of this discussion, right? All that, right? What does it mean to write? Do you actually have to write, or do you have to own, right? Things like that. If you inherit one, if you buy one, right? All those questions. Primarily, we're going to be focusing on Rashi, the Rambam, and the Rush, right? Those are the three main Rishonim that we're going to be dealing with, not a million. And then sort of the analysis of those Rishonim. Oh yeah, but I'm going to give you a lot more than that. That we're going to on the Psukim I gave you, I think the Targumim and the Netziv, the Shlal David, the Aruch HaShulchan, the Rambam. The problem with the Rambam, and I held back from giving you the 14-page piece that I just finished reading by Rucham Fischer Perla because it's and really, really hard to read.
Thank you.
You're welcome. See, it could always. This is how I should always do it. I should tell you what I could have done and what I did, and then you won't be angry at me. Okay?
You're not gonna traumatize us.
This is not gonna last long.
Yeah, no.
Next month.
Theologically, no. In other ways, possibly.
You guys will get that 14 page.